This episode is brought to you by the new October term, open now at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are going to Skyfall. Yes, we are probably going to tackle one, I think, the most popular films of the year. It's certainly right up there in the sort of top five. It's coming through like gangbusters at the box office. But more than that, it's really appealed to a lot of fans, new and old, or if there are any new fans to be had, of James Bond franchise, because it's got in many respects the kind of Bond that we grew up with, tempered and mixed in with a very new and sort of current Bond. Joining me to discuss the film is a little different this week, because we want to discuss this type of film, an action film. So we're going to be joined by, firstly, Matt Leonard, who's been with the show before. Matt, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me back again.
And Ed Moore, who is actually not a VFX guy, but a DOP, certainly a good friend of
VFX in. Guy.
No, it's good.
How are you? Thank you for having me. So, very well, thank you.
So one of the reasons that I really was keen to get Ed on the show, Ed and I have actually worked together and done a bunch of stuff, but I also know Ed has a bit of a man crush on the DOP for this film, Roger Deakins. And I think Roger Deakins' role needs to be discussed. I think we need to discuss the role of cinematography and what's captured on set, because you can't really adequately discuss a Bond film without discussing how it's shot and what's then done in visual effects. At least a few years ago, I think, the Bond films actually veered perilously close to death when it actually tried to go very VFX and digitally, and now it's sort of swung back to being much more having this kind of gritty reality. That being said, there are still quite a lot of visual effects in the film. But before we get to that discussion, and I think it'll be a good one this week, I did want to just get the guy's general opinion on the film. So Matt, starting with you, do you think I'm right in saying that this is a great mix of kind of old Bond that we remember with the kind of new post-Bourne ultimatum Bond?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I really enjoyed this movie. It was, funny enough, at the beginning, I was actually at the point where I was thinking of not seeing it. I just thought the last two I pretty much liked, but I just looked at the initial trailer and thought, you know, I might just give this a miss. And I'm so pleased I didn't, because for me, this is probably now my favorite Bond film ever made. So I absolutely loved it and really pleased I saw it.
There's been a few of them.
There has been a few of them. It's been going for a while now, hasn't it?
So yeah. It was interesting that this plot didn't keep going in the way that the previous two had done, because the previous two films had set up this idea that there was this master sort of conspiracy organization. I think M at one point even says, how could we not know about this organization that's this big? It was sort of setting it up, I thought, for a third film to come through as part of almost a trilogy to address the who were all these sort of Mr. Whites and Mr. Blacks and everything else going on. And instead of doing that, it completely went for a different plot line altogether, which, I don't know, you said you weren't super keen on the other two, but you know what I mean, Matt? Like that, there really was
that.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, the way it ended, obviously, we're going to end up having to say some spoilers.
Now,
in this,
we should, I think we should, big spoiler alert. We will have huge spoilers in this, but can we just agree, guys, to avoid the main spoiler, just on the off chance? So I don't think we need to discuss the main spoil, because it's not really a visual effects thing, but leaving that aside, keep going.
It just felt the way it ended to be almost winding back the clock to the Bonds that we love, the kind of the Sean Connery kind of feel and everything that Bond was at that point. And it just felt like it's gone through these three films and now it's almost not a reboot, that doesn't feel right, but kind of a here we go kind of feeling.
It has certainly reintroduced a lot of characters, including Q and others. And it's given us back a little bit of the humour. Ed, what did you think of the other two that had preceded this, Quantum and Casino Royale?
I was a really, really big fan of both, actually. I think I'm quite unusual in liking Quantum of Solace. I think just because Casino Royale was such a strong return to form that it was pretty difficult to follow that. I think maybe Quantum of Solace suffered more from from the kind of producers felt like they were going, oh my god, Bourne is a thing now, and we have to kind of respond to that. But the first two work so well. I think Craig is just probably my favourite Bond now. I think he's done such a great job. It's hard to imagine almost who could go on from him now. So they set a pretty high standard for me. So, you know, I think Skyfall had everything to play for this one. And I personally think it did a remarkable job. I agree. I came away from the cinema. My first guy had a proper fanboy reaction of that was amazing. And the more I've seen it a couple of times now, I still really like it. As time's gone on and more people have seen it, there's been more and more discussion. I've been surprised actually how much kind of, or how split it is. There's plenty of people love it. It's obviously a huge success, but there've been more people than I thought have reacted, you know, sort of just not that impressed. But I definitely count me amongst the fans.
Yeah, I really liked it, and I thought it was really good. I think that there was a concern of it getting cheesy, especially during the Roger Moore years, where it was just sort of... And then it had been so parodied, I can't even say that word. it had been so made fun of by Austin Powers that that it, you know, if it didn't kind of get a bit more gritty, it would have, I think, become sort of a pale imitation of itself, but it did reboot well. I do think this three films are an interesting, and I'm going to stick my neck out here and say almost Star Wars-esque, as in the original 4, 5, 6 theme, that, you know, sort of the first one set the stage, the second one was dark, and the third one came through with a bit more humour, as I remember, you know, great trilogies gone by. So, I'm okay with the second film in context, but I'd say I do think the plot line changed. I'm sure at some point this third film had a completely different plot. Now, I'm going to ask you to comment on the director before we get to the DOP, because actually neither the director nor the DOP, if you were to sort of just look on paper, are action flick franchise folk, are they really?
I thought that the direction, after my fanboy reaction, because there's lots of lovely fanboy moments in there, I think even before the cinematography, the direction of this feels very deft to me. It feels really, it felt more subtle in places than other Bond films, certainly a lot of the Brosnan and Roger Moore ones. I thought he brought, you know, it became this kind of three-hander, between you know, Bond, the baddie, and M, and that worked really, really well. He brought out some really nice stuff. I thought the performance that he got out of Javier Bardem was fantastic.
It was good, wasn't it?
And I just, you know, and it felt like it didn't totally. A few people have said, oh, they didn't feel like it had enough big action sequences. I think it had plenty of action sequences, but I really enjoyed the rest of the space around it and all the bits where you kind of want to know. You know, rather than it just being constant Brosnan-esque big set piece after another, there was actually a bit of space to learn more about the characters.
I've got to say, one of my problems with Bond films, and it may be that I'm just getting old, is that it is possible to fall into that problem of now we're going to have the chase where the tank is going across the, you know, St. Mark's Square in Venice, and really there is no plot here. And we're just going to have to get through this set piece and then we'll get back to the action again.
Yeah, you know? And it's all second unit suddenly, really, obviously.
And there's no dialogue. And, you know, it really... Cause this is, I think, actually... now I'm sticking my neck out again, but I think this is something we've seen with Marvel's franchise work with its films, with the superheroes, which is get a director that isn't of this genre, that actually has some real theatrical as well as dialogue-based work, and then give them this to play with. And then you get this interesting mix because you don't just get what you expect. You get, you know, because there actually is quite a lot of reasonable amount of dialogue in this. And I didn't miss any action sequences, but more to the point, when we had any action sequences, with the possible exception of the opening on top of the train, I didn't go, okay, well, we're just going to have to sit here for a while this goes on and then we can get back to the plot. Now, I felt that slightly with the opening sequence on the train, but then by the same token, I was so happy to be sitting in the cinema that I didn't really care because it was a bit of good old Bond action. And
it's just so kind of established now, that kind of big pre-credits action sequence, that it's difficult to stray too much from it. But I think it does stand out as being not, you know, I think that's probably the sequence that had the most second unit stuff. I think it stands out a little bit as being a little entity onto its own, but that's the whole structure of Bond films. I mean, that's just well established now. You have that sequence, you go into the credits, and then you kind of the real
film starts.
Meat of it starts. Yeah,
I have to say, as a kid, I remember, and now this is, I know, horrible, but I grew up with the Roger Moore. And I remember the best opening sequence ever for me was, I think, Spy Love Me, where it was the snow skiing sequence. And at the end of it, he goes off the cliff. And then suddenly it opens with the Union Jack. And it was almost like, as a kid, you were just cheering. I mean, it was just like, you know.
Which is why, I don't know if you saw the Olympics opening ceremony live. But I mean, that whole moment where they fake the Queen and stuff and they jumped out of the helicopter. And then when the parachutes open, their Union Jack's then. I mean, I probably jumped off the sofa just clapping. That was such a great moment.
That had to be one of the greatest film tie-ins in history, getting Her Majesty to actually star in effectively a Bond promo. I mean, I think it was valid because it's a great part of English history and English cinema history. But yes, I must admit, of course, I had the same reaction. Firstly, I was like, good on her for doing it. And then secondly, this idea of, well, who else would bring the Queen to the... obviously, they'd send Bond.
Yeah. Well, I remember when they... the sequence with the helicopter in the... I remember when they were shooting that in the summer because everyone had spotted it. And I remember Jason Cuddy, a folks that I work with a lot, had walked past Buckingham Palace and actually shot some video on his phone and sent it to me saying, I've just seen this amazing helicopter and then a sort of filming helicopter lifting off Buckingham Palace. It must be for Bond. And then everyone saw them do the thing where they flew underneath the top bit of Tower Bridge. Everyone was saying, half the people were saying, it's definitely for the Bond movie. And half the people were saying, it must be for the Olympics. And actually, they were both right.
Yeah. Now, the thing about the Bond films is the opening title sequence. So let's come back to discussing the visual effects, both of that initial train sequence, which was, really good. But I want to just start with the title sequence, because even though it isn't the first thing we see as an audience, mentally, the Bond opening titles are kind of the start of the film. And I think also there's a tremendous legacy of just spectacularly good graphic design. Matt, what did you think of the death underwater card kind of vibe of this particular opening sequence? Because bullet target stuff that was done for...
Initially, having seen the film twice, it made more sense the second time because it kind of is the film in that opening section. There's so much in the film that then gets shown in that kind of opening section. I was kind of split. I mean, the fluid dynamics work that Framestore did was just spectacular. All the kind of organic stuff I really, really liked. But then things like the dragon didn't quite seem to fit or tie in for me. I don't know why. Maybe I wasn't quite in the frame at the time, but everything kind of outside of the dragon, I absolutely loved. It just looked gorgeous. It all fitted together. All the nice columns had that kind of tilt shift kind of miniature feel about them, and that all seemed to tie in really well. So overall, definitely liked it. Just that one little kind of dragon section in the middle just felt it just wasn't quite working for me, but overall I would definitely give it a...
So if we go back to Maurice Binder's original stuff, his original Bond sequences were in an age where you had these big titles up the front and everyone got their name up the front, but more than that, I mean, they were risque, incredibly daring. I mean, Man with a Golden Gun, I think it is, where you've got a woman gymnast going around a gun barrel and they're like naked chicks. Okay, they're in silhouette, but they were still just outrageously kind of edgy. And of course, back in the day, they had to be done a lot more with just straight photography. Ed, what did you think of the opening titles?
I thought they were stunning, and I really, really loved the transition into them as well. I thought that was so effective with just coming out of the water, and then you just suddenly get this huge hand coming up. It actually took me till the second time to realise that the whole plot of the film is in the opening titles. Once you sort of pick it out, really, really strong. I love the whirlpool-y sand stuff. I thought that was a beautiful image. Top marks.
He did shoot quite a lot of live action for that sequence, though.
Oh, really?
Obviously computer graphics, especially for doing the skulls forming out of what I guess is the fluid sims of blood, or it could be whatever it was, smoke.
And am I right in saying that this is, because the previous one was a different VFX company, this is the same guy as has done tons of them, correct?
Yeah, it was a kind of return. So... Maurice was the initial guy that was just
back from like GoldenEye, right? Or even
then. Yeah, exactly. He was he was the original kind of person that defined that look. And then I think it's Daniel Kleinman, is that right? I think who is the current one that's the, that you're referring to. And I think what's really good about it is, as much as a kid, I just thought the chicks naked floating in space or bouncing off off trampolines was just the most outrageous thing ever. You really can't do a title sequence like that because it's misogynistic to the point of just being ridiculous to have all these naked chicks flying around. So you have to have a feeling of that. And I think you can have some. I mean, I think there is one woman underwater shot, but you can, you know, you need some of that. But you can't just have a bunch of naked chicks flying around. It's just ridiculous in this day and age. So I think he's done a really good, walked a really good line in having a feeling of a Bond title without just being as derivative as having a new way to show silhouetted naked chicks.
I thought it for me, the only thing it lacked that I just absolutely adored about the Casino Royale one was just the ending of the Casino Royale one as he walks towards camera and it kind of transitions from being a kind of stylized silhouette into an actual shot of Daniel Craig. I thought that was so effective with the music as well. I think it maybe didn't have quite as big. I thought that maybe the start was better, but it didn't have quite as powerful an end as that one.
I did like the Casino Royale one with the use of the sort of cards, and also had this kind of Mad Men feel with the silhouettes. But I just thought they had to do something different, and this was valid and different. I think the other thing that was awesome on, I think they did it in, it's Casino Royale, I'm sure of it. The beginning of that film started in black and white, didn't it? And then
really grainy. Right. I don't know whether it actually was. It looks like kind of 8mm or something. I'm sure it wasn't, but it has that feel.
But Matt, from your point of view, it was pretty seamless as to what had been obviously done with, I guess, Houdini and what was shot for real.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really pulled you in because there was so much depth into all the shots. So, I mean, it was hard to tell, what was obviously shot live action and what would have been fluids or some kind of organic animation taking place. And I'm guessing they went with a kind of a Houdini fluid sim for some of it. And as Ed was saying, all the kind of the sand pools and that blood or whatever it was that was floating around just really helped to, it just seemed to draw your eye into the picture all the time. You were always straining to look into the shot to see what was going on as it kind of took you through this journey. So yeah, I think it worked fantastic.
Yeah, I think that Framestore did a really good job. There's a bunch of companies that worked on the film, but Framestore, I believe, was behind doing the primary work for those opening titles. And obviously, a big London house does really, really good work. But there's actually quite a lot of detail in those sims, and those details, in a sense, are actually not what you got in the old days when you had the very graphical kind of, because this, the dragon sequence, the mirror cracking with the bullets on it sequence, a bunch of that stuff's not that graphic. You actually see a lot of stuff. It used to be almost a sort of two-tone silhouette, and that the floor of the whatever it is that those things are falling into, the targets are falling into, and you kind of get this sort of shooting up stuff, I thought was really, really good. So.
Mm.
It's good to get some. The other thing I was going to mention is the song. What do we think? Because Bond songs can be either really good or really bad. I mean, I don't think I've ever liked anything more than I liked Live and Let Die, which I thought was to this day. maybe I prefer slightly different versions of it than I did back then. But yeah, it's still an all-time classic. What do we think of the Bond song?
After you, Matt. What do you think?
It wasn't quite Shirley Bassey, Diamonds Are Forever, but it wasn't also terrible. So I quite liked it. I wouldn't rush out to buy it as a single, but I certainly didn't put my fingers in my ears when it came up for the second time. So, yeah, not too bad. I know my daughter seems to have been playing it 24/7. So not too bad at all.
I liked it too. I thought it's got those big, big crazy Bond chords with, diminished 97th and all that kind of stuff, and I always like seeing how they're going to work the ridiculous title of the Bond film into the lyrics. Did quite a good job on this one without giving away the plot.
I guess for me, it's it isn't the single that I'm going to play in the car, but it's exactly the kind of song that you want for the opening of the film. And I think this is an important point, because in the past we've occasionally had artists produce songs that are better singles than they are music credits. And this was like, clearly they weren't, I mean, they were going for something that's going to be popular, but it didn't feel like they were going for, hey, if we can just get a charting single, that'll help promote the film. It was more like, hey, this is a really good song for the opening of this film. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think it was William Bartlett at Framestore who headed up the team there, and just huge thumbs up to that team for the great work they did. Okay, so now let's go to the sequences. And for this, as I say, I want to discuss the cinematography, because Roger Deakins' work is really important. And I want to actually start by something that I was a little surprised about. When I went to see this film, I got to see it in 4K, which surprised me because the film wasn't shot in 4K. And I was sort of thinking to myself, well, this is going to be a bit of a waste of time, really, because we all know an Alexa doesn't shoot 4K. Yes, it's the first Bond film that's digital, and that was going to be interesting. But I thought, you know, a big fuss was made at the press screening that they'd installed this special 4K projector. And I thought, you know, almost jokingly, well, it's not going to do you much good because you're not going to gain anything by going to 4K. Boy, was I wrong. I just don't know. I've ever seen anything Bond-like look this good. In fact, I had to keep checking myself that this was, in fact, shot on the Alexa, because in 4K, I guess what happened is, instead of losing stuff that you would see on the kind of neg by the time you see it projected, in other words, you sort of, you know, you've written into the equation normally is a loss from the projection process. They kind of minimized the loss so much that it felt like I was actually watching something better than I was. What I saw on the screen in 4K looked just like pristine stuff I might see on a flame screen when I've got a clean scan or a file loaded. It was spectacularly good. I mean, it was more than I expected. It was just really surprisingly good. And I have to say, it was almost a bit frighteningly good, thinking, why do I need to shoot 4K if I can get stuff looking this good off 2K?
I just need to record that bit. Certainly.
Yeah, I know. Hey, so what did you think, Ed? So, do you see it in 2K or 4K?
I saw it in 4K, yeah. I mean, I had the same reaction as you. I was initially cynical, but it was my local kind of multiplex at Cineworld has just put in a brand new, you know, IMAX, because IMAX digital, obviously it's not real proper old IMAX, but it was £2 extra, so thought I'd give that a try. And it looks sensational. It looks really, really good. And I understand that obviously they were shooting with a codec, so they had access theoretically to the, you know, 2.8K, if you like, and they went from that. But from you may know more details about this, but you know, IMAX have their own what do they call it, DMR, I think it's DNR, they call it, process for upscaling content that wasn't originated in IMAX to the IMAX format. And so apparently they tested that and Deakins hated it, or you know, certainly thought they could do better. So they actually did their own upscaling in some other method, and that's what you see, which it slightly upset me. At the end of the film, it's probably just an automatic thing, but they've got a whacking great IMAX DNR remastered logo at the end, which they should probably look at taking off, seeing as it was specifically rejected. But yeah, I mean, wow, I don't know how much better it could look, really.
It was like that, wasn't it? It just that was the exact reaction I had. It's like, how much better could this look?
Yeah.
And that same week, I'd been shooting film 4K on the C500 and 5K on the Epic. And looking at that on a really good flame monitor, I was struck by how bad the 35mm looked, even though it was great 35mm, and it was 5.219, and we shot it, scanned it at 4K, so I was looking at a 4K minimum in all cases. And it didn't look bad, it just didn't look as sharp as what I was seeing off the two digital cameras. And it now no longer is an issue of looking good or bad to me, it's just a completely different look. I've rejected the notion that one is better than the other, or even that one is sort of superior in sharpness, though it obviously is. It's just now film has a sort of halated film look that is so different. In no way is it even sort of sensible to compare it to what I'm seeing off these. And that was C500 recorded on the same codex box that these guys used, all the same, you know, model.
Okay.
So I think obviously shooting on codec is absolutely vital. Otherwise, you're shooting in a recorded, you're recording a compressed format to the.
Although I have it on I have it on good authority. There's a few shots in this where they forgot to roll the codecs, so there's some ProRes only shots made it through, but they certainly didn't jump out.
Yeah, and I'm sure if you get the exposure right and you do everything correctly, you're going to get great results on ProRes, but mm-hmm. but you're not going to have the grading latitude to do the sort of things that you're going to want to do, and so I'm willing to bet that the sort of shots such as him arriving. On that float at the casino, you know, the sort of Chinese gaming shot, which was very theatrical but just had super saturated reds and tons of mm-hmm. what looked like clever window grading on Daniel Craig. I just don't think you would have got that as cleanly on ProRes as you would have of the RAW files, but I guess we'll never know.
Yeah, maybe.
Matt, what did you see it at? Did you see it in digital? Did you see it? I mean, I've seen it digital, but did you see it 4K or 2K?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I think I saw it 2K initially, and then the next time I saw it, it did feel a lot crisper. But the cinema I went to, they seem to have no clue. So I'm guessing it may have been 4K. And it, I mean, as you said, it looked amazing. One of the things that struck me really quickly was just the grade of the film and just how deep all the blacks looked, how rich it looked. Am I right in thinking that Roger Deakins shot most of this with Master Primes?
Yeah, he loves them.
Excellent. Okay,
and it's a good piece of glass.
Yeah,
it's not a bad piece of glass. Well, he has this thing where he doesn't like putting filth. He doesn't like putting anything really between the front element and the lens, and you know, so the less glass, the better for him. And I think that was a thing with the Alexa, by the sound of it, in interviews, and that you know, has this kind of sweet spot of 800 ASA, and that inevitably means that you're going to have to put NDs in front of it almost all the time. So there's some kind of, you know, adaptation needed there, I think, in the future. But interesting.
There's actually some very colourful sequences in this, because if you were to look at a couple of sample frames from the film, if you look at that, him arriving at the casino, that's incredibly red. If you have at the end, the fire sequence is incredibly yellow. And then that assassination scene at the high rise is super teal blue. I mean, these are really, really strong colors. Do you know who graded the film? Because I think they've done Roger Deakins a real service. I think this is a really good grade.
I don't know, but I do have a magical Word document in front of me that may tell me. So continue onwards.
So
I'm seeing Company 3 for the DI.
No, that doesn't actually narrow down who the colorist is, as they have some of the best colorists in the world.
Yeah, it could be anything.
On staff. I'm sure we can IMDb it while we're talking. But I thought that the footage looked spectacularly good, and being that it was digital and 4K projected, it really, Matt, didn't give you many places to hide. So let's start with you. Did you see anything that kind of sat out from a compositing point of view? Because we were looking at a super high-res, very pristine kind of print.
There were only, overall, I loved pretty much every single shot in the movie. There were only two comp shots that stood out as there being something not quite right, and I think it was probably just an integration issue. But overall, it just sat all together so nicely. And as I've looked into it more over the last kind of few days and discovered how things were shot in different places to where you initially thought, and just some of the compositing that's been done, I think it's just all the companies that worked on it have just done an amazing job in getting that quality to sit so nicely together.
So what were the shots you thought maybe didn't kick it?
I'm not saying I could have done any better, but the one of the shots was right at the very beginning in the chase. I think it was in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's where they shot it. There was a shot of Bond on the bike on the rooftops, coming towards camera with the camera tracking back with him. So he pretty much stayed where he was, and that didn't quite seem to tie in. It was probably actually shot for real, so I don't know, you know, what I was
seeing. I have a bit of info about that shot, because I know exactly what you mean. It jumped out to me too, and I did ask a friend who was involved, and it sounded like, because I thought it might have been, apparently there are some epic shots in there, and I think that might have been because they had the flying cam guys with an epic on the kind of RC helicopter. So my friend was asking me, oh, maybe it was an epic shot, and I think when we worked out exactly what shot I thought maybe they'd stabilize something and had to frame in, but I think by the sound of it, there was that shot of Craig. I don't think he wanted to go up on the roof. I think so. That's a comp shot, and I think there was, you know, so that, anyway, I don't know the exact details of the shot, but certainly that he isn't really there in that shot.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually thought that the epic shots, so the super flying over shots where clearly it's beyond what a technocrane can do. Though having said that, a big technocrane can do an amazing reach. So it's sometimes you think it's a helicopter shot and it is a technocrane shot. But anyway, yeah, some of those traveling shots are done with epics because they're smaller in this flying helicopter. I was going to mention that as well. I actually thought they looked just as good, if not identical, to the Alexa. I wasn't picking them at all, and I knew that they'd use an epic for that stuff. But yeah, I think the shot we're referring to here has got nothing to do with that. I think it's just literally to do with trying to match the lighting and the look with a comp shot. And what was your other shot, Matt?
My other shot was further on when Bond had gone to Shanghai, and he was following the guy up to the top of the building where he was going to do the assassination, and then there was going to be the fight. And there was a two shot where, as he went up in the lift, the bad guy goes up in the lift, Bond jumps onto the bottom section of the lift, and it did a shot with the camera looking up as Bond went up, and then it cut very quickly to a shot looking down as the lift obviously rose up. And it was the downward looking shot. Again, the integration just didn't quite feel right. I don't know whether there was just the edges were not quite integrated in, whether it was a bit too crisp, but it just felt like Daniel just stood out just a little bit more than maybe he did on some of the other shots. But other than that, just those two, where both with Daniel Craig and both edges or lighting not quite right, everything else to my eye looked gorgeous.
I'm pretty sure that the assassination stuff in Shanghai was all Dienig. Andrew Whitehurst was in charge of that. They also, by the way, handled the opening train stuff with the wire and rig removal, but we'll come back to that in a sec. I guess for me, the problem with the Shanghai stuff was, I mean, I sort of know what you're talking about with that shot, but I actually felt almost everything to do with the Shanghai stuff felt very soundstagey. I didn't really believe that they were going from one building to another building pretty much at all. I believed that it was in camera. I just believed it was on a soundstage. If you compare that to what we got in Dubai in the Mission Impossible, the last one, or in the earlier Mission Impossible film when I think they were in Shanghai, when they were swinging around from one roof to another, I just felt like that just had a set soundstage feel. What do you think, Ed?
I actually didn't have the reaction at all. I really bought it. I was more concerned with just a really weird plot issue with that whole sequence, which is why is the guy assassinating the guy from another skyscraper at huge complexity when all of the people in the room with the guy that's being assassinated are clearly all in on it? Why don't they just shoot him? But no, apart from that, I was really sold on it. I thought it, you know, obviously transitions in from you know, the stuff outside the skyscraper and then the lift sequence. So by the time they got up to the top, I was so kind of blown away by the that look of the lit entirely by those LED panels or whatever they are on the outside, that I didn't have time to think, oh, this doesn't seem like, you know, we are where it says we are.
Yeah, I felt it felt stagey. And also that when he went out the window and he was holding onto Bond's arm, felt just all...
And then the guy bounces off, which just reminded me exactly of the exact same shot in Titanic where the guy falls off the back and bounces off the propeller.
It felt like a scene that, yeah, it was, again, I mean, if you can't judge Bond on absurd plot twists, because let's face it, there are a lot of like ridiculous, why did they go to the
trouble
of doing
this? There are so
many
in this film that just make no sense.
Yeah.
I still love it though.
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. But, I mean, you know, it just, I think it's really hard to light these mega sets to look exterior. And the trouble is they are so big, those Bond soundstage sets. You know, I mean, I felt pretty much the same way about him arriving at the casino. That felt also like it wasn't on location. It felt like it was on a soundstage to me. But
I think you know too much.
Well,
I think you just...
Okay. What, were there any shots that you didn't sort of feel came up to par, Ed?
I actually don't think there were, but I mean, I'm so clueless really when it comes to VFX that I guess it's not immediately obvious to me. But I mean, there was stuff like I kind of have a, you know, awareness on a practical point of view that, that, you know, it would be impossible to shoot that sequence on the approaching the casino for real. It was just too good to be true. But certainly, you know, I've watched it a couple of times now. I think maybe that the third time I'd start to be a little bit more dispassionate about it. But it you know, rollocks along, this film. I didn't really have much of a chance to think too hard about that stuff.
Well, let's just finish on the sort of negatives and we'll get into all the positives. I think there are definitely more positives than negatives. I think that the train sequence in the underground, where the train comes crashing through the floor and causes the escape prior to the... it's not really at the end, but it's the assassination attempt on M. It's before they go to the Scottish Highlands. Anyway, there's an entire tube train that effectively plummets into the area that they are underground. Now, my problem with this is threefold. Firstly, I applaud them for doing it pretty much for real, because they actually did sort of build a soundstage that had a fake tube train that crashed down. My problem is, and I also applaud the fact that Deacon shot it pretty much in locked off shots and didn't, you know, try and make it all sort of super shaky cam. But there didn't seem to be anyone on the train. So that was sort of, why is there no one on the train? Like, why is there an empty tube train? It seemed almost too odd to not be worth a comment from somebody. But I guess they didn't want a whole lot of people killed and Bond not looking after them. And by the same token, I just don't ever remember getting on a tube train ever during daylight hours in England that it isn't pretty much got people in it. And then also the set piece, by its very nature of just having this huge train kind of crash down, was so over the top and so ridiculous. And like it was like there needed to be more reason for doing it, because you've got...
How
this...
How does he know Bond is be standing there?
Yeah, and that a train would be coming in at that exact minute, and that just like everything else. And so it caused me to just query what the hell was going on, and that caused me to look around the shot a lot more. And hence I started finding problems with it, like the fact that the train seemed empty and that it was very kind of, as I say, stage constructed and felt like it was contained inside of a set. Now, did it look real? Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure if a train crashed through, that would be pretty much like how it would be. I probably would have added a bit more dust and dirt. But I just, it did feel not wrong, but lacking in people in the train and lacking in the kind of dust, debris, clouds that we now associate with major disasters. I think ever since 9/11, we just kind of think that when anything like that happens with concrete, there's just such a dust plume that you really can't see what's going on. And it felt like that train crashing through meant no one got that dusty and that sort of, you know, covered in just chalk. Like I would have expected Bond to walk out of there like he was literally white from head to toe in kind of dust. And even, you know, could he have walked out from all the fumes and the dust and stuff. So I just, because it lacked a lot of that volumetrics and because it seemed empty, it didn't really work for me as a scene. But I know maybe I'm alone. Matt, what do you think?
I slightly disagree. Just from my point of view, I like the scene. I didn't think too much about how it happened time wise, as you were saying. I mean, why would he be stood there, and why would it come through that moment? But I'd seen a little bit online. There's some videos online that actually show the kind of the B-roll or what it was like before it went in and they made it look pretty, and it seemed to make quite a lot of mess. They obviously built the whole thing on, I guess, the 007 stage up at Pinewood, and they must have shot it, as you said, with a ton of cameras, because there was no kind of crazy Bourne identity moves going on. But I'm wondering whether they just held back on the dust just so we could keep an eye on on Daniel Craig, because I think there's a shot where it comes through from top right and crashes down towards the left side of screen, and there's, you can actually see Daniel Craig running across to some alcoves on the far side. And I think if they had kept it as real as it should have been, as you were saying with some of the attacks that we've seen on TV over the years, you probably just wouldn't have seen him, and they probably wanted you to see him scurrying away somewhere. But I think on top of all that, they did add quite a lot of kind of dust and volumetrics digitally, I'm guessing, to try and, you know, enlarge the explosion and the general debris of it going through all those pillars and things as it crashed down.
What do you think, Ian?
I was going to say there was a shot in there actually that the first time that really jumped out at me, and I don't know whether the whole thing was. I've seen some of the videos, and they obviously have a kind of what looks like a pretty much one to one reconstruction of a tube train. But there was one shot in there. I just swear when I watched it the first time, there's just one kind of profile shot of it going through where it just suddenly like jumped out as being a tiny model. So I don't know whether that's just my mind, but it just mostly looked awesome. And I just remember there being one that just suddenly looked like someone was holding like a Hornby Railway model of a tube train going. I'm sure that's not the case, but I think maybe it was just such an extreme huge thing, and you don't really have a kind of sense of what that would look like in real life, and maybe just something in my brain was just, no, I don't accept this is really happening. There's obviously there's huge numbers of model making credits in the end credits. I guess they could be model makers for the full scale stuff as much as smaller stuff. I just wonder whether anyone knew maybe if they'd snuck in a few different scale models into that sequence.
Well, CineSite was responsible for working on it and in doing some enhancements to the real stunt that happened. I think John Neal was running that, and they had to remove cables, and I think there was a camera operator that was in shot that was removed, some stuff like that. I don't think the visual effects were so much of a problem as I think that the line was drawn too heavily on the side of practical over visual. I think if you'd done that just as a visual effects sequence, you might have been able to do it a bit better and a bit more believably. I just felt like they were so determined. I mean, I on the whole, I support them doing a lot of stuff practically, but on that one shot, I just felt like it was just very much a strongly, we're going to do this for real, but that introduced some constraints, and those constraints just didn't make the shot as strong or the sequence as strong as it possibly could be. But hey, you know, I mean, it's kind of...
It's interesting as well, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, when it comes through, it's you've got that shot of Daniel in front of the camera with it coming through the hole, and then it cuts to it kind of pouring into the tunnel with Daniel running away. You could easily have done that main big crash second shot with a digi double and just do the whole thing digitally without having to go to the expense and the build of such a huge set. So yeah, as you said, it's interesting that they went that way when they could have done it digitally, and CineSite could have easily have pulled off that environment and that train to look, you know, as gorgeous as it did for real.
Yeah, well, you felt Steve Begg was the overall VFX suit, but Chris Komold was the special effects supervisor, but he's also listed as a miniature effects supervisor, so maybe there was a miniature. I'm not aware of that, but they haven't published an enormous amount about the visual effects for the film yet, because it's still opening around the world in various places.
The only miniature I've heard of is the MI6 explosion. I think that was a miniature.
I heard that wasn't. I actually heard that the MI6 explosion was live action and digital over the top. So, I mean, I could be wrong there.
Thought just one final thing on the tube sequence. I did really feel like I didn't feel particularly like Bond was really threatened by it.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
Just he seemed to just kind of was like, oh, I'll just step over here then, out of the way.
Get out of the way. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, like the Austin Powers thing, like, oh, who throws a shoe? That really hurt. You know, it just, he kind of just got away with it and then continued with the chase. I suppose there is an argument that the baddie does it because it causes a distraction, and then later on you do see that there's tons and tons of police and ambulances and stuff, and they're all in the other direction to where he's about to trying to attack M, but yeah, it didn't quite, it did feel a tiny bit like, you know, the script was presented and the producer's like, great, we think there should be a bit where a tube train crashes. It's going to look amazing in the trailer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, again, we're just being a little negative, but, you know, there are always going to be these odd things in Bond. Like, he gets on the boat with the girl and suddenly they're arrested, but he gets to have sex with her first. I mean, if you're going to arrest them, could you not arrest them before she shags my wife, please, or my girlfriend?
I mean, hey, I was just grateful that to see some proper London disaster big VFX stuff, because I'm sick of the New Yorkers getting all the Godzillas and monsters and everything. It was good to see some effort being put into destroy London in some meaningful way.
Okay, well, I'm going to swing the conversation around to the really good stuff now. I'm going to start with that opening sequence where they're on top of the train. Firstly, I think it was terrific the way Dean Egg basically did just wire removal on that, so that you could actually have the actors on top of trains. With safety wires allowing them to do that, which are then removed digitally, it means that you got a thoroughly entertaining sequence. I mean, if we leave aside this issue of whether or not it's plot developing, everything about that seemed to work from my point of view. It worked them being on top of the train. It worked when he got shot off the train. It worked when the train it's being pulled apart by the huge piece of machinery
thing.
Yeah, and the thing about that is it was also good Bond stuff. You know, he decides to use the stuff at hand, you know, crushes the, what was that, it was a VW Beetle or whatever, you know, when the car's swerving. The other thing I thought was awesome is that, as you probably picked up, they had the actress who was playing Eve in the car pretending to drive while a stunt driver was on top of her car actually driving, which means you get those terrific shots of her looking like she's actually driving without green screen comps. And all they have to do is be careful to then, you know, cut to a wide shot where you've actually got a stunt driver back in the car and you can't see it's Eve. And the audience just buys it. You just don't realize there's a whole, virtually a second car on top of her car, on top of the four-wheel drive. I think it was like a Land Rover or something. And that gives it great realism. As long as she just sort of turns the wheel to the left when they're going to the left and not the other way. I think it's a spectacularly good way to shoot an actress in situ and be pretty safe. I mean, obviously not perfectly safe because the stunt driver could crash both of them, but boy, I thought that works well. I thought everything about that sequence just was a really good technical blend of VFX helping out and practical doing a great job. Clearly, though, you need a heck of a lot of pull to be able to have a train on a real track going up and down. It would take a really long time to reset for the shoot sequence if she didn't
back
time
to ones
probably.
yeah
back to ones
six
is,
miles
is
back.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, am I alone in thinking that just almost was faultless from a technical execution?
No, I completely agree. I think it works. It's a really good character. It's a blend of character and action all in one. You establish her as kind of mavericky and supporting him, and you establish him as semi-indestructible, getting just shot again and just kind of shaking it off. But also, I think it's not just a Bond thing to do with the excavation stuff. It's a very Daniel Craig Bond thing to do. You know, he has that kind of just aggressive, just brute strength kind of thing about him. So, you know, just fantastic. And just the kind of confusion in the guy's eyes that he'd do anything like that. Really, really good. Loved it.
I mean, that parkour sequence had established that in the early, I think that was in the second film, wasn't it? Or was that in Casino Royale when, you know,
yeah, Casino Royale, which does have like a kind of another big bit of industrial kit in it that he just tanks into something. It's nice to see that.
It does. That does have that sense that he, because I think in Casino Royale, he shoots in front of the surveillance cameras. And there's that sense that Bond is unstoppable. He's not a fine scalpel. He is a blunt instrument and he's
and
just going to keep coming.
I like that we've seen in plenty of films that it's kind of been established that Bond can, you know, fly helicopters and do whatever. And I also just like that obviously he knows how to use a Stinger. You know, it takes him 2 seconds and he can use anything as a weapon.
Yeah, and he's just going to grab anything and keep coming at you. And then the fact that they didn't have to do a lot of green screen meant that we got really believable shots, just a much, much better solution doing that wire removal. I mean, it was a hell of a job. And not like Dean Egg hasn't done some spectacular wire removals, i.e. Inception. But, it's hard work sometimes to do that stuff, but, man, it pays off for the final film. Okay, so I loved that. I thought that was really, really good. I tell you the other sequence I loved to death, and Matt, you might want to comment on this. I thought the helicopter at the Scottish house was really good. I mean, I was sitting there thinking, how would you do this? And I'm thinking, well, is it okay to destroy someone's house? Is that a fake house? Is that a fake helicopter? Have they got a helicopter on a crane that they're just dropping in? I mean, if you did that, how many times could you do it? Like, I just, at some point, made myself come out of the film and just started looking at that helicopter attack, helicopter crashing and blowing up. And I just thought, man, this is well done stuff. And to add to that, and I'll come to you in a second, Ed, there was just spectacular cinematography around it. But firstly, Matt, I think that helicopter sequence was just a cracker.
It was fantastic, wasn't it? And I'm right in thinking the backgrounds were shot up in somewhere like Glencoe, weren't they, in Scotland? And then the real house was rebuilt, I think, somewhere in Surrey. In the south of England.
So MPC was responsible for this, and they,
that's right,
they,
yeah.
There was a stitched Scottish background that they were dropping in there. And I believe, now I don't know this for a fact, but I believe most of the helicopter crash, there was a significant amount of live action, but there was also a CG stuff, and it used MPC's Kali, which is a finite element analysis destruction pipe, which I'm really big on. I think that the MPC destruction pipe is one of the best in the world right now. And as a consequence, I totally couldn't pick. I mean, if you're listening to this from MPC, just hats off, guys, because at what point you took over or did stuff, I can't tell. I mean, you know, if you want to blow something up right now, I want MPC on my speed dial. I mean,
I heard helicopter was 80% real, 15% model, 5% VFX.
Okay,
was what I heard.
Well, it was good. I mean, there was just.
100% awesome.
Yeah, it didn't look fake, and it didn't look stagey. It didn't look like any other criticisms I've had. None of them apply. It didn't look like it was on a soundstage. Didn't look like it was VFX. Didn't look like it was staged for the camera. Didn't look like it was pointless. Didn't look like it was unlikely to happen or impossible. In every respect, it was great. And then, Ed, you get Roger Deakins cinematography laid over the top.
Oh, which, yeah.
Just...
Yeah, I mean, what a just a brilliant excuse just to sell. I mean, just throughout this film, I think his just use of practicals, not just practicals actually lighting the scene, because I think in many cases there's tons of other stuff going on, but just every single scene has a really, really clear source of light. You know, call it a key light or whatever, but it's more than a key light almost, because there's just this kind of justification throughout. There's no kind of, if you compare this movie to something like Iron Man or Avengers, which both I love the look of those films, but they have particularly Iron Man, just such a kind of gloss, and you just accept that wherever, even if they're standing like, you know, in the middle of a basement or whatever, obviously there's an amazing beautiful backlight and amazing beautiful key light and all that kind of stuff, whereas this film the actors look amazing throughout, but it kind of makes sense visually, so I just kind of, and that just that particular sequence made me think of all that, just because it's all lit, it makes sense. You know, earlier on you see them shuttering up the windows, which makes sense, and then the whole place is full of dust sheets, which makes sense. So when you have a helicopter with a searchlight, which you see, and it makes sense, and you have these just beams of light, with the height changing, the lamps obviously moving outside, and then that becomes your key light, and it's bouncing off all the dust sheets inside, and it's bouncing back on them. It's just magical.
That shot for me that I just couldn't believe is the full silhouette of the baddie walking with the burning fire behind, you know, because he's done that before. He's done it in, what did he do it in? It was like, it was either Old Country for
New Men. But was that coming out of the hotel or something?
He'll let people get into complete silhouette in a way that just has balls, that guy. And then not only that, but this is a guy who, like, you know, 5 minutes before is giving us effectively E.T., Close Encounters lighting, with that lighting that you were referring to. But earlier in the film, in the Shanghai stuff with that neon, like it's a kind of Blade Runner-esque neon.
Well, someone actually said to me that they, someone actually said, oh, it felt like this film didn't really have a consistent grade. I think they meant kind of look all the way through. And
I thought it was consistently almost brilliant.
it was consistently made sense. It wouldn't have made sense for every scene to look identical because of the locations. And Bond is, you know, in part about traveling all around the world and different kind of looks and stuff. So I just, every scene had a different, or rather every location had a look to it that made sense.
Well, that
I keep saying made sense.
But the evil lair, which was basically they did the scare of the chemicals to get everyone to leave the island. Just, it was post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, apparently they'd done it. Yeah, I mean, it looked like they'd abandoned it about 80 years ago rather than 5 years ago. But yeah, I mean,
it was desolate. It was white. It was monochromey. It was just, it was post-apocalyptic. And he's doing this in every friggin' setup, but it doesn't look like he's just, like, you know, sometimes directors do that. And I've pointed to the film, what was the one? I think it was Armageddon, yeah? And they would just suddenly go to a location and it would look like a car commercial and it would be, you know, all lit like a beer commercial.
Yeah.
And it was slick and completely out of character. And then they go to the next location and it was suddenly beauty lighting for a, you know, Victoria's Secrets parade. And it was just like one look that felt like it was plucked out of a commercial after another. This one, it's completely different looks, but as you say, totally motivated, gorgeous in their own right. But in no way did I feel like, oh, now they're doing the look from, you know, Playbook 4. Now they're doing the look from Playbook 5. It was...
And I'll tell you my favorite lighting story about this movie, which is that I look through... There's a book by Greg Williams of just fantastic production photography from this film. And I kind of pored over it to see any little hints I could find about Deakin's lighting, and you know, it's just remarkable how little you see. You just don't see film lights particularly in any of these shots. So you know, you kind of think, well, maybe there's bigger stuff outside the frame, or you know, whatever. That one of the shots in there is of the scene where he first meets Q in the gallery, and they're surrounded by quite a lot of. It's a wider shot. You see them. You see the camera, and they're surrounded by a lot of kind of bounce, all white bounce, kind of 45 degrees back up because that whole ceiling is just glass in there. And you think, God, that's amazing to have the guts just to do it like that and to bounce it back in and just to get the look. And I had this conversation with a DP friend of mine called Steve Murphy, and he was like, "Oh, I bet they had stuff over the top of that. You know, it's a huge movie. You just never dare to." Shoot in there, and you know, just the clouds go in, and suddenly it's all different. You'd never dare. I was like, no, it's Deakins. He's got this documentary background. It's how he does it. So I asked my friend who worked on the movie, just tell me, was there any other lights used in that scene? And he said, well, put it this way, we shot that at night.
Oh, God, really?
So the entire, because of course, as soon as you think about it, they can't, you know, they're not. Even Bond would struggle to close like the National Gallery or wherever it is. So you know, there's obviously this. I didn't get into details, but there's huge cranes over the top. There's endless 18Ks or whatever you would need to just bring up that light level. But it's all outside the room, and I love that. It's fantastic, and it gives the director so much freedom as well because you can point the camera kind of wherever you want, and it's going to look great. You don't have to worry about stuff being in the shot. Yeah, so amazing practical use, and then just huge lamps out of the location when you needed the firepower.
Okay, well, not to be outdone with anecdotes, I'm going to come up with mine. So I heard Deakins talk, and you were there, weren't you, Matt, in Sidgraph?
Yeah, definitely.
And so he's talking about a whole lot of really good films, Sid and Nancy and Her Brother Were Out There and No Country for Old Men. So great stuff. And obviously he's done a lot of stuff like Barton Fink and Fargo that's quite, you know, it's all Coen Brothers and interesting. He's also done some other stuff that I think shows up in this film, like Revolutionary Road, but it was Jarhead. And I asked him whether he had an opinion on shooting green screen and stuff. I can't remember what my question was because, you know, I was kind of keen to get his view on green screen and stuff. But anyway, he told this story on Jarhead, which I have recounted before, so I apologize if you guys have heard this, but listeners, it's worth it. So he was on set apparently for that, and the camera is facing... one way, and the camera has to kind of follow a character round, and there's meant to be a whole lot of stuff in this destruction in the film Jarhead, which is obviously set in current times in a war sort of Middle East setting, and the stuff wasn't there. There's no sort of things on fire and stuff happening and stuff, but they did have some fire and goopy stuff dripping down from a supposed thing, but that was like off a crane, but it was a sort of pretty easy. And so apparently he's talking to one of the ILM guys there. I won't name this member for respect, but you know who you are. I know who you are. And he says, so it'd be good to have green screen up here as we, you know, and Deakins goes, but I'd have to have it all the way around here, right? Because it's like, it's a huge pan. So it's like a massive amount of green screen all the way around. And then there's going to have these bits of flame and stuff. To which this ILM supervisor, who is a really nice guy, goes, yeah, all right, don't worry about it. And Deakins says, sorry, don't worry about it for this shot or ever again. and now when somebody on set goes, I need green screen and all this other stuff, and he goes, well, I'm not going to name the guy. Well, the guy from ILM said that he didn't need it, and so he just gets out of it. And Deakins, I think I'm right in saying, was his quote from that same session where he said, you know, no one on screen sees the... Oh, no, it wasn't actually. It was from... we shot up at ILM's model shop, which is now 3210, and the DOP there said, and it was great, he said, no one ever sees the green screen in the film, so you don't get any points for getting the green screen right. You get points for getting the actor right, and then if the green screen has to suffer, well, so be it. But, you know, you want to get the green screen right, but you can't do it at the expense of getting the foreground actor right, and so that's just how it is. So, you know, accept it. And I can't argue with that logic, but I've got this, oh my God. Anyway, so so his attitude to visual effects now is, you know, they'll make it work, all due to a certain individual at at ILM.
Like, I guess he's fortunate enough to be working on projects where they can probably afford to, you know, if they have to spend 4,000 man hours doing a 2-second shot or something, I guess they could do it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and I think you touched on this, Roger Deakins did actually have a documentary background. In fact, you know, he wasn't known initially for being, you know, a Hollywood, as we said, it wasn't certainly not an action DOP. And yet these days he's as much known for that as for these bigger films, as he is also for consulting on CG films, which I think is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really, I always find him sort of, he always seems slightly surprised by kind of where he's found himself and the adulation in which he's held now. But whenever you see any of his lighting, it is usually really, really simple. And I, you know, if you knew the magic trick of how he manages to pull it off like that, I guess you'd be Roger Deakins. But you know, I remember on Revolutionary Road, he'd build like little units out of 650 watt Fresnels and the really little simple bits and pieces. By no means the only DP that does sort of stuff, by the way, but he doesn't particularly go in for newfangled-y stuff if he can do it with just a bit of bounce and a bit of white cloth and stuff, but he knows exactly where to put the bit of white cloth.
Yeah, but also he doesn't feel the necessity to, so I said you got to get the foreground looking right, but he's not at the point where, you know, he feels like he has to make Daniel Craig look good in every shot. Like, he lets Daniel Craig's character dictate the shot, not Daniel Craig the actor dictate the shot, which does require a level of, I don't know, both reputation and just presence, because the man has a lot of just gravitas when he's standing in the room, right? Like, I mean, he just doesn't come off as somebody that, I mean, he sure comes off as, I mean, you just don't want to say boo to him, right? I mean, he's just,
well, there are not many DPs who could come onto Bond and it would be like, God, Bond's getting a good deal, you know. You usually be like, oh, this is such a huge deal for this DP, you know. They're like, as soon as Mendes got on it, everyone's just, oh, I wonder if Deakins will do it, it'll be amazing. And everyone's like, no, they won't, because the next Bond will have to be 3D. They'll definitely do it 3D, and Deakins will never do it 3D. And they were right, he wouldn't do it 3D. I don't know if that was ever a consideration, actually, Mike. I don't know if you know anything about that.
I don't, but I'm glad it wasn't. It's felt that it wasn't, it didn't warrant it. And also, this throwback to kind of a retro Bond, which, you know, was not hurt by having Aston Martins and stuff in it, it just wouldn't have felt, you know, right. It would have been a different thing altogether. Hey, Matt, what did you think about the destruction of the Aston Martin, and also the fact that the darn thing, the Aston Martin, that is, was pretty much made with a 3D printer? Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that at all. I thought it was sad that they had to blow it up. I was hoping that they would keep it and he could drive off into the sunset in it, but it wasn't to be. I'm guessing MPC used the same destruction setup that they used for the house, Is that, would that be right, or was it practical?
I think the bullet hits and stuff, but the actual thing that blew up was this 3D replica, 3D printed replica of an Aston Martin DB5, and
it just looks superb, didn't it? The same as with the house blowing up, the finite element tool destruction set just really worked. It was what was nice was just the detail. I mean, it was super quick. It was over pretty quick once it actually blew, but just things like the reflections that were in the glass, and just the way the debris came apart and all the physics that were involved just made it look super, super real, which was really nice.
Well, I have a tiny plot point, which is somebody wrote, and I don't even think it was in the film, but somebody wrote, oh, this is the Aston Martin he won at the poker game in an earlier film. And I'm like, really? Because if it is, then somebody got to it and installed some pretty cool gadgets in it.
Yeah. You have to kind of get, and also, why does Judi Dench not notice that there's another person called Moneypenny? Because she obviously had another Moneypenny before. But I guess on that note, why does she notice this entirely new James Bond? But
yeah. But here's the thing. I want to tell you about this this 3D printer, because I think this is really interesting. I got a bit of information on this. This is a Voxeljet 3D printer from Germany. They used it to create the model, which was 3:1 scale. So 1/3 scale is pretty bloody big. But anyway, they made it. They could have actually made it practically as one element, but they made it from 18 separate bits, which they then put together using this VX4000 massive bloody printer. But the thing I think is really funny about this is that they did, you know, this amazing chrome paint job on it, and all the bullet hole details and finishing touches and stuff. And the guys that worked on it, I think, were prop shop model makers in the UK. So, but the thing that's really awesome is because it's a 3D printer, right, they didn't just make one, they made several. And then one of them that didn't get destroyed, they sold at Christie's for $100,000. So, you know, it's like, how are we going to afford to do this as a miniature? Actually, if we make it a miniature, we can actually make another one, sell it, and it'll pay for the whole bloody thing. Oh, great. Well, that's good. Thanks.
So that was just for the shot of it getting blown up by the helicopter?
Yeah, you know, it gets bullet riddled and zapped and stuff. Well, all of that. It wasn't,
yeah, okay.
It was not a real one that they were destroying, because I was thinking, well, even if it was...
And it was 1/3 scale. Okay.
1/3 scale. Now, there is stuff that's happening to that that was put in by MPC, which is what Matt was referring to. But as I understand it, most of the car that we saw was this 1/3 miniature. But I just think it's hysterical that, you know... Because I can understand that, right? Like then a DB5... prop from a James Bond film would go for a lot at auction, but the idea that, you know, well, let's make it in a 3D printer and then I'll just print, you know, copy two and that'll pay for it.
Why stop at one?
Yeah,
so, you definitely get 80 grand for each one, surely.
They got 100 grand.
How much does it devalue? Well, just thinking, if you made multiple copies, you'd start to devalue, wouldn't you? But I reckon there's some sort of equation you could do to work out the optimum number.
The optimum number that you can hit out of your VX4000
printer.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
I've got to say this is
1/3 scale. There's a few 5-year-olds that are going to be very happy, I guess.
But I've got to say, this is the thing that is actually saving the ass to a certain extent of miniatures and items like this, because it used to be it was cheaper to make it in 3D, but now you can make it in 3D and then have a 3D printer make the parts, which is much more cost effective, and that means you can make a lot of them. And you can use them. So not just this, but obviously, you know, if you're making weapons, for example, like guns or something, you can make a ton of them from a 3D printer. Obviously, you've got to do a really good paint job on them. But, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a matter of you come up with some contraption. It would be expensive to build them, and we should probably do them as CG because they're going to, you know, cost us a lot. It's not really super cheap to use a 3D printer of this scale and complexity. But, man, these 3D printers are... I'm hearing about them everywhere now in filmmaking, and I think it's only going to get bigger over the next 5 years. And, you know, when I started out doing commercials, we used to always make oversized versions of the product to film, because it would get better results if we could have a bigger version of it than shooting at actual scale. And I'd love to see that come back in. I'd like to see, you know, a lot more practical photography done. But the digital is now in making these overscale, not scaled down, but overscaled versions of things to film. I don't know if you've ever shot an overscale miniature, Ed, but you know, you can obviously do a better job when it's not.
I haven't. I've heard rumors that, you know, when they shoot kind of adverts for Magnum ice creams, that the Magnum is kind of 2 feet across. I'd love to see one.
Yeah, that's exactly what we've done. huge buddy things, and the paint job is always central to making that sell, as obviously it was in this car, because you've got to get that really great pearl type paint finish, and so don't get me wrong, it doesn't come out of the printer looking like that, but I think these printers are phenomenally interesting, and we're going to see them really coming into force in the film industry, especially in special and visual effects. And also the thing, of course, it's the same file, right? Like, it's the same computer file that's feeding your CG double as feeding your practical on set. You know, it's not like you have to scan the one on set and try and reproduce it in 3D. 3D makes it, and then you hand the prop to the prop guys. It's an awesome way to work.
And that's going to make a great... I mean, that's so going to help, isn't it, in lineup and things like that, when you're placing your 3D elements that you want bits to fly out of, or any of the additional things you're adding in as a dynamic sim. It's going to fit in the dash, or fit in the front wing, or wherever you want those bits to come out of. It will be a perfect replica.
Yeah, you have a microphone exploding in some sequence. Don't just grab a microphone and then, you know, get some stills taken at the front and the side and try and replicate it. Just give them the microphone that they're using, because it's the one that you designed in 3D. I think it's you know, it's a really good way to work. I think also I've heard rumor that some of the, you know, telephone, iPhone-y type commercials, you know, very large scale versions of phones and things for those sweeping product shots, because you can do it when you get that, that scale. It just works really, really well for getting cameras in and being able to move around and stuff.
I'm very, very curious about some of those shots, just some of the movement and stuff, because I know that they... I've heard they're very, very fussy about not doing just complete CGI replacements of some of the stuff. So I'd love to know how they do some of the kind of model moving and things, just to make it so absolutely perfect. I've heard rumours of a of some sort of hand model vice, almost, that just holds their hand in absolutely the most perfect position. But that, I think it's unlikely any behind-the-scenes shots would emerge from those sets, but I'd love to get a look in.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I think we've covered most of the areas. There is probably a bunch of other bits and pieces that were done throughout the film. We only briefly, I guess, touched on the explosion that causes M to witness the death of a whole bunch of agents. And as I said, we don't know how that was done, but it looked to me like it was a live-action location and they added CG over the top. Apart from anything else, it would have been an incredibly difficult thing to build that as a miniature. There was a lot of water in the foreground and the rest of London all around it. So if it was integrating a miniature into a live action set, that would have been pretty hard. Having said that, maybe there were some windows and elements that were miniatures that were then comped into that. But it was a good sequence. And of course, you know, it was suitably dramatic to set the tone for the second act that really got us running. Is there anything else anyone wants to comment on in terms of the visual effects, all the shots? Have we missed any of
them? There was a couple of... go ahead, Ed.
I was going to say, did you guys like the scorpion and the Komodo
That's what
dragons?
I was going to ask. Yeah, right. That's exactly what I was going to ask, yeah.
So I think the Komodo dragon was done by Cinesite, and I thought it was really well rendered and animated, but I just didn't believe that it was a suitable threat. I mean, a Komodo dragon,
nice reference to the, you know, the Roger Moore jumping on the alligators thing, though, when he escapes out. I thought that was nice.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. But it was well rendered. I thought the scorpion was pretty well rendered. It did feel a little bit like it was CG, but then I can't rule out the fact that I just in my head figured that there's no way they're going to have a real one, and there's no way they were going to bother with an animatronic one that was radio controlled. But what do you think, Matt?
I liked it. I was the second time round, I was really staring at it, mainly for the tracking, because I thought it's going to be hard, because the way Bond was moving so carefully, obviously, to portray him having this scorpion in his hand. I thought slower tracks are often much harder than a fast moving track. And it definitely seemed to sit there, and integration wise the lighting looked great, and that quick take of him dropping the glass on top again looked nice. From what I've seen from B-roll footage, it looked like when he did that there wasn't a scorpion in the glass, so they would have had to do some kind of glass replacement to put the scorpion in it. But overall, I really like that sequence. It felt...
I thought the the animation on the scorpion to as a layperson seemed really good to me, assuming that I guess you have to do that by hand because it's difficult to get little tennis balls on an actual scorpion and film it somewhere.
Yeah, I'm guessing.
I just look very really. I suppose maybe easier to animate things like that move in a slightly unnatural way anyway, rather than the person. But it seemed to just have the kind of slightly unpredictable, skitterish threat feel came across really well.
Yeah, and I think whoever animated it has watched a lot of scorpions because it definitely was getting more agitated the closer he was moving his hand to his face, which is pretty much what they tend to do.
Yeah, I think it did what it needed to do, and it was good. And you know, I didn't really question it. I guess I think I probably questioned the scorpion as digital more than I questioned the Komodo dragon, but. It sounds like I'm down on it because I was saying, you know, things like I just kind of discounted it as being a Bond-esque moment. And I wasn't. I really thought this was like one of the best Bond films ever. And I thought it was very, very well done. But I think it's testament to how well it was done that when you have these elements that are either retro moments or moments that are plot absurd or just, you know, just ridiculously, characteristically, just shoot him. No, I've got an absurdly complicated way to make you die kind of thing. that you didn't just go, oh, God, and roll your eyes. Like, I think the director needs a lot of credit because he's managed, if you pick it apart, you can find like a dozen of these things that just really don't make any sense or aren't particularly effective or not very, you know, obvious. And yet in the movie, I'm, you know, practically, I mean, our audience broke out in spontaneous applause when they showed the Aston Martin for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's real craft to get an audience to go with you that well and to be that into the picture that you just forgive every one of these obvious plot problems and you just don't get upset with it. You just, you're willing the film to be a success. There was no point where I was like, sort of wondering how long the film was or, you know, waiting for this action sequence to be over so we could get back to the plot or just saying, oh, I don't understand what's going on here. I thought it was great. I thought, it was just...
You know what we've forgotten?
What?
And it's unusual.
I know what you're gonna say.
The amazing work by Lola when he takes his teeth out.
Yeah,
that was
amazing.
Creepy stuff.
The face drop.
That was very creepy.
How does that work? that seems like magic to me. That seems difficult.
Yes.
is that what you might describe as a non-trivial effect?
That would be a non-trivial effect, especially as it's hero to camera.
That's not After Effects, you know, effect menu, drop down, distort, face mode.
Plug-in number.
There you go, render.
$20
Let's get another cappuccino in here. Yeah. Okay.
No, that was good. Actually, it was very good. You know that to be a Lola effect, do you? Oh, that's good.
Yeah, yes, I believe it was, yeah. And I'm guessing that would all be Flame then? They do a lot of
Hydraulics and Lola, and there's a pretty thin line between the two companies these days, though they are separate, but they're in the same building. And but they're Flame-based guys, and they're exceptionally good at what they do. I mean, I think some of their work is... Like Ed, for example, you remember in... Captain America, they had the young puny Captain America that was all done with the same
Skinny
technology
Steve.
Of just and it's really your eye compositing very, very well. There is no secret.
I read the article in what's it called, Cinefex, about some of that process, and it just blew my mind. I mean, how much work went into making that work.
Yes, you could also have read the article on FX Guide, by the way, but that's okay to read the one on CineFX.
Okay.
But yes, it was really good work. They just, no, it's fine. But that really, it's like, it's breathtakingly precise work. And as we all know, our eye is so attuned to faces that when you start doing that stuff with faces, you know, you can pick anything. I mean, the subtlest little thing that looks wrong, your eye goes to it, you know it's wrong. You can't articulate maybe why it is wrong, but... You know, there's just nowhere to hide. I mean, the scorpion, like if the scorpion doesn't move like a scorpion, I have really no experience with scorpions. There's no part of my brain that's hardwired.
It sounds like
dealing
Matt
with
does,
scorpions.
Though.
Well, he does, yeah.
He's a scorpion guy.
I shouldn't have, but...
Matt's lived a pretty wild life, I've got to say. We won't talk about the biker years.
Back in the day.
Or his back tattoo. But yeah... So yeah,
you said
okay.
You weren't going to say.
So on that note, I think we might finish up again. Huge kudos to those involved. And we've sounded a bit picky. I certainly sounded very picky, but I loved the film to death. And I think the visual effects teams did a really, really good job. And I think Deakins did a spectacular job. But yes, to Steve Begg and the entire crews at the various companies, they did a really, really good job. Hey, Ed, where can people find you and follow you on Twitter and stuff?
On Twitter, I'm just Edmore, E-D-M-O-O-R-E. That's usually the best place. And my website's edmoredop.com.
And you'd like to tell us what you're up to at the moment? Are you filming?
I've just finished a new drama series for Sky Atlantic, which is called Con People, comedy drama. That's out in January in the UK. And I'm just about to start shooting a commercial for a homeless charity here in the UK, which I'm hoping to do on this new Sony camera as well.
What were you shooting the drama on?
The drama, like so many things, was Alexa. But only S+S cards. But yeah, Alexa and Cooks and yeah, it was a great shoot. Really, really fun.
And so it looked pretty much identical to this Bond film then.
Yeah, I got all the kit and I just turned it on and it just looked like Bond. That's all there was to it.
Yeah, yeah. You look at this Bond film and you say, wow, those cameras are so good, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Ari.
And Matt, how about you?
The best place to find me is, again, on the Twitters, just as Matt D. Leonard.
And, of course, I'm on Twitter as Mike Sneal, although the best place to find me is at FX Guide. So with that, and with almost it's time for the martinis to break out here, I'll say goodbye. Thanks so much for being with us, guys. We really appreciate it. Sorry the story went long, but hey, I really enjoyed it, and I love the film. If you haven't seen it, I recommend you see it. We try to stay away from the killer spoilers, but it is just a great, great film. Until next time, see ya.
Any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.